Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer Melissa L. Savigny. She's a science journalist at KNAU, Arizona Public Radio, and we're talking about her latest book, Brave the Wild River, the untold story of two women who mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. Melissa, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
That's great to be here.
I'm just going to admit it right here. This was one of, for me, one of the great books about doing science, especially for women. It is an amazing story about persistence in the face of insanity. And how did you first come across the story? I was shocked. I'd never heard of these two women.
Well, I had the same reaction when I first ran across these two women's names. You know, I've lived in Arizona all my life. I grew up here. Thought I knew a lot about the Grand Canyon and the Colorado River and its history. But I just completely by chance ran across the names of these two women, Lois Jotter and Elzeta Clover. Lois Jotter's archive is here in Flagstaff, where I live at the university. And I was looking for something else, and I stumbled across her name, and I read this little description that said, you know, these two women went down the Colorado River in 1938 and made the first formal plant collection for Western botany. And I was shocked that I had never heard of either of them before. And initially I just wanted to read more about them, so I started poking around trying to find more about the story. And there were a few things out there, but there really wasn't much. And eventually I came to the realization that I was going to have to write it myself.
Well, first of all, there's the story of the trip down the Colorado River, which, even if they weren't doing anything, is an insane trip. And
yes,
plenty of people had died before that. Then they were scientists. Both of them were scientists who were consistently running this, or at least participating in this, as a scientific expedition. And then there's the fact that they were women and the blowback they got all along the way until probably the very end was just frightening about how much anti-female sentiment there was. You start out the book with a quote by Roy Chapin Andrews: "I know of no more effective way to wreck an expedition than to put in one woman, or worse, two." That was 1932 that he said that.
Right.
So there was their persistence in the face of that, and it makes just an incredible story.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, and those are the three threads that I really wanted to weave together. You know, the river running itself, which is full of adventure and excitement, and then the science, which is, you know, the fascinating botany of this region, and then the sexism they faced, all of the obstacles put in their way, people telling them, like, women shouldn't be doing this kind of thing, and it took a lot of grit and tenacity for these two women to ignore all of that advice and go anyway.
Well, first of all, I want to talk about Elzeta Clover. Mm-hmm. What's up with her first name?
It's actually Elzeta. Elzeta Clover. Yeah, she's kind of funny. She's got an interesting name. The story that she would tell later in her life was that she was named after a Spanish pirate ship.
That's right.
And I tried to track that down, and I can find no reference anywhere of anything resembling a Spanish pirate ship named Elzeta. There are some ships out there named Elzeta, but not Spanish pirate ships. And I think that's actually a pretty good indication of her character. She was quite dramatic. She loved stories. She was a wonderful storyteller. And there's kind of, I don't know, a bit of like glamour over her life, kind of this mysterious glamour that she carried with her. I think she was just a fascinating person.
Oh,
very unusual for her time. Yeah.
There's this full-page photograph of her in the beginning of the book. And if you were to just look at it and not think about it, you'd think she looks like a librarian from the 1950s. But I would just want to read this quote from the book. "She was a tall woman, active, robust, dramatic, daring, perhaps just a little bit wicked. She drank whiskey. She could swim, fish, hunt, and ride a horse. She preferred to describe her own code of behavior as gentlemanly rather than ladylike. She was noted among her colleagues for not bothering to take shelter during rainstorms. And even her research specialty, cacti, was the least demure plant imaginable, all showy blossoms and spines." And she loved to teach.
She did, yeah. And she's a good example of not judging people by appearance.
No kidding.
She's always been described as kind of this buttoned-up school teacher. You know, she was in her 40s when she did this trip, which at the time she was considered kind of, you know, an elderly woman, right? It was fascinating to dig into her life, to read descriptions of her from students who knew her really well, from family members, and, you know, the description she wrote of herself. She kept a wonderful diary during this trip and really sort of uncover her character. It took me some doing because she was a very private person, but the more I learned about her, the more fascinated I was by her.
Let's talk about Lois Jotter. Now, Lois Jotter is much younger than Clover.
That's right. She's 24 at the time of this trip.
And Clover was 41. Mm-hmm. They're both from the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was Clover's idea to do this trip. Why was the botany of the Grand Canyon so important at that time?
Well, Clover had this somewhat audacious idea of doing a complete catalog of all of the cacti in the Southwest. Her specialty was in cactus. Right, yeah, no big deal. And this was something that hadn't been done. I mean, plenty of people had been out in the West cataloging the cactus, but there really wasn't, like, a complete catalog at the time. So she had the idea that she was going to do that, and she was going to places by car as far as she could get. And she, one day in 1937, while she was doing this, she runs into a guy who has a dream of starting a river running business in the Grand Canyon, which is not happening at the time. You can't just sign up for a commercial trip down the Grand Canyon, right? So they both have these kind of crazy dreams, and they just kind of collide one evening out in Utah and decide that they're going to do it, that they're going to go together. And for Elzada, I think the importance of the trip was that no one had done that before. Of course, the indigenous people of the region knew its plant life very intimately, but for Western botany, there wasn't any catalog of the plant life along this stretch of river. It was bigger than the Grand Canyon. They went through down the Green River and then through Cataract Canyon, Glen Canyon, Grand Canyon, ending at Lake Mead, which was just then filling up. So it was more than 600 miles of river that hadn't been explored by a botanist.
Now, Lois Jotter, she was still getting her degree?
She was, right, she was working on her PhD at the time.
And she was invited to go on the trip by Clover?
Right, right.
Now, so they also brought a zoologist from a man from... who crapped out halfway through the trip.
Right, right. And yeah, he wasn't the only one. A couple of the men about halfway through decided this wasn't very fun for a lot of reasons and decided to leave. But the two women stuck it out and recruited some new boatmen. And they made it all the way. So, yep.
Now, for people who don't know the history of the river, especially at that time in the 30s, talk to me about why it was dangerous to go down the Colorado River.
Well, mostly because people weren't really doing it very often. So there wasn't a lot of experience on how to tackle, you know, this stretch of very difficult rapids through the Grand Canyon, especially, and through Cataract Canyon, which in some ways was even scarier than the Grand Canyon at the time. You know, again, indigenous people have been running this river forever. So the earliest stories that I know of river runners are actually from the Hopi people who build boats and go down this river. But for non-native people, like my characters, like Clover and Jotter, they didn't know a lot of people who had tackled this trip. There were only about a dozen expeditions that had successfully gone through the Grand Canyon between John Wesley Powell going down in 1869 and Clover and Jotter coming along in 1938. So that's a long span of time where people just really weren't doing this kind of trip. And a lot of them came back with horror stories or disasters, and the boats had capsized. Sometimes people died, you know. So the idea at the time was that this was a pretty dangerous and a pretty crazy thing to do. They didn't have good maps. They kind of scrapped together some boats, this kind of untested design that nobody had tried before. It's not like you'd just go out and buy a boat. So they didn't really know what they were getting into.
The amazing thing, how long in miles from the Green River where they started down to Lake Mead is it?
About 660 miles, more or less.
And a lot of it's through really bad water. I mean,
yeah.
You're just sort of blithely going in cataracts, and I don't think most people have in mind what it's really like to be in these canyons when the river was at its peak. It was frightening.
Yeah, I mean, and they, you know, they go at a kind of a bad time of year. I assume they, you know, the schedule was chosen because they had to go in summer when the two women weren't teaching. But they go right at the start of the monsoon season here in the Southwest. So it's the start of the rainy season, and the water's really, really high. I mean, we don't even really get big water like that anymore on the river. And they hit the Colorado, and, you know, their diaries, most of the folks on this trip kept diaries that I used to reconstruct this story, and they all expressed their shock at how powerful and how, you know, just raging this river is when they reach it. And, of course, immediately things start to go very wrong.
Well, I wouldn't expect anything else.
Right.
I mean, it's one of the scariest trips to have made at that time in the United States. Now, before we get back to that, this is all set against the background of the role of women in science at this time, which was virtually nil.
Yeah, I mean, you know, botany is such a fascinating field because in the 19th century, it was very welcoming to women, and the idea was that, you know, young, genteel women could go wander around in fields of wildflowers, and they could pick the flowers, and that was a very acceptable activity for a young lady to do. But that had all kind of started to change by the 1930s. The field was becoming much more professional, much more university-based. There was a lot more laboratory-based work with microscopes. And as that happened, women started to get shut out of the field. And so Elzeta Clover in particular really was in botany kind of at the wrong time for her. Like, she wanted to wander around and explore, and she didn't want to stick to nice, you know, fields of wildflowers. She wanted to go down this, you know, big whitewater river and collect cactus. And that was not considered an acceptable thing for women to do.
There's a quote in your book, you write, she wanted to collect plants from places she couldn't reach by car.
Mm-hmm.
And that just was unacceptable to the public. It was amazing. I mean, you recount in tremendous detail the press. Before they even set, you know, the boats out for the first time, everybody was making such a huge deal out of the fact that, why are these women doing this? I mean, don't they know it's really dangerous? Nobody said that about the men.
Yes, that's very true. Yeah.
And when they did write, they never wrote about the fact that they were scientists.
Right. Yeah. It was so frustrating to me reading those news articles. And, you know, I could tell it was frustrating to Clover and Jotter, too. You know, in their diaries, I could see them writing about how they were responding to journalists saying, well, we're botanists. We're going to do botany. And none of that would show up in the news article later, but all the about the fact that they were women. And there was a lot of focus on that, particularly because about a decade earlier, a woman had tried to go through the Grand Canyon. Her name was Bessie Hyde, and she and her husband had the idea of going to the Grand Canyon on their honeymoon, and they disappeared, and they were never heard from again. And this was used as basically an example of how, like, women shouldn't do this trip. Like, they were literally being told, you will die if you go on this trip. You know, no acknowledgement that her husband also disappeared on that trip. It was just a very big focus on their gender, which was kind of fascinating to me, but also quite frustrating.
And they were relentless in their collecting. I mean, they collected every time they possibly could. They collected plants.
They did, yeah, and that usually meant getting up before dawn or staying up after sundown. They weren't quite prepared for how difficult it was going to be just to get the boats down the river. And by the way, they were also doing all of the cooking for the entire
trip. Yeah, I want to mention that. The first time I read that they were, like, cooking supper for the guys, I'm going, what the hell?
Yeah, yeah.
You could rotate this. You could...
Right. I thought it would be logical. And it's funny that there was no, like, commentary on this, like, in the letters that Elzeta Clover exchanged with the trip leader before the trip. There was no discussion of, like, who would do the cooking, or, like, she didn't volunteer. It was just accepted. The women were going to do all of the cooking. There was no conversation about it. So, you know, they were quite busy. They were quite tired. They were staying up quite late to make their plant collection, and yet they achieved so much. They collected hundreds and hundreds of plant specimens, which still exist today in Bavaria all around the country.
Now, let's talk about the process of collecting plants. How do you do it, and what did they do?
So what they would do is they would, you know, cut the plant or maybe uproot it and try to get the roots as well. They would press it between pieces of newspaper, and then they would stack those together with blotting paper, which was meant to keep the plants dry. That wasn't totally successful considering the conditions. And then the whole thing would go between two pieces of wood, and it would be cinched tight, and that was called a plant press. And they were creating these as they were moving down the river. And I actually asked a friend who works in the Grand Canyon region, who's a botanist, like, that sounds all well and good, but how do you do that with a cactus? You know,
they were
specializing in cactus. And she says what they probably did is they would cut the, you know, you take like a cactus pad, you would cut it lengthwise, and you have to scoop all the pulp out of the middle, and then you would put that on the newspaper, but you have to keep all of the spines intact, because that's part of how you identify a plant that's a cactus. So pretty tricky work to do, and you can see, you know, scans of these plant specimens online, and they're beautiful. They're beautifully arranged, you know, kind of looking like they're natural, still growing, and so it would have been kind of tricky, finicky work to do, especially, you know, late at night with a flashlight after everybody else had gone to bed.
And they have to keep all the notes, too. They have to keep regular detailed notes about where they were found. And that was important because it was thought that different zones would be from the top of the canyon all the way down.
Yeah, you know, they had a lot of questions going into the trip. Again, nobody had done kind of a formal botany study of this region. So, you know, they had questions about what today we would call ecosystem science, although they didn't have the word ecosystem at the time. But they were thinking about how plants from different deserts were kind of mingling in the area of the Grand Canyon. They were thinking about those zones that had been identified a few decades earlier by a scientist. You know, if you ever hike the Grand Canyon, you see them very clearly. You move from like pinyon juniper forest and then, you know, down into the desert, and you can see these transitions. And they were really interested in kind of understanding how that all worked. And they ended up coming up kind of with their own system to describe what they were seeing and how plants were living in different sort of microhabitats of the Grand Canyon and how they were affected by things like topography and the angle of the sunlight and, you know, the animals in the region. And today we would all think of that as ecosystem science, but it's quite incredible they were asking those questions at a time when the word ecosystem didn't exist.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer Melissa L. Savigny. She's a science journalist at KNAU, Arizona Public Radio, and we're talking about her latest book. It is a wild read because it's thrilling and fascinating science. Brave the Wild River, the untold story of two women who mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. Melissa, they also found out that in certain areas where mules were coming down the side of the canyon to bring people down, that their hooves and stuff were bringing plants down too.
Yeah, I was interested in how many non-native species they would find in 1938, and they actually found quite a few, and some of those were like, you know, oats that were growing along the trail that had spilled out of the nose bags from the mules, you know, things like that. So I thought, you know, it just shows how keenly they were observing the environment around them as they were also doing this very difficult work of getting down the river.
Now, the not only is the water wild, incredibly wild in certain locations. They're in these three little weird wooden boats. But even to sleep overnight, basically they're just sleeping on these gravel edges to the canyon, way down at the bottom of the canyon, where sometimes the water level would creep up while they were sleeping.
Yeah, you know, and this is still more or less the case today. You know, people kind of have to fight for space to camp down there. You have to camp on the sandbars that are created along the canyon walls. But today, you know exactly where the water's going to be when you sleep at night because there's a dam upstream which regulates that. They didn't have that dam upstream, which meant that, yeah, sometimes they would choose to sleep a little too close to the edge of the water, and they would wake up and their feet would be in the water because the river was rising all night. Kind of scary. And I can say from personal experience, it can be quite frightening to sleep on the edge of the water because it's so loud. If you're near a rapid, it's just constantly making this roaring sound all night, and that takes a little getting used to.
Well, it was funny, as after they made this trip, which took them, how long did the trip take them?
42 days.
When they finally get out to Lake Mead, the lack of sound, they make note of.
They do, yeah. They're all sitting around one evening wondering why it feels so strange, and then one of them realizes that the river isn't making noise anymore, and it's because the river has become the reservoir. It's become Lake Mead.
Now, I'm going to leave out any more description of the trip itself, which makes up the meat of the book, because it's absolutely thrilling reading, and people need to read that section. But I want to talk about their sort of legacy afterwards. Did they stay friends for all their life?
For most of their life. You know, they eventually drifted away. Their lives went in different directions. They ended up in different states. Lois Jada got married and had a couple of kids. And they corresponded for quite a while after that, but I think eventually kind of drifted apart, as people do when they end up far away from each other.
And they were two very different people.
They were very different people. They had very different trajectories for their life, which is something I love about their friendship. I know it was a friendship that kind of crossed a generational divide, and it crossed over, quite a few differences in their personalities. But I can tell, even, you know, very late in her life, the way Lois would talk about Alzada, that she was, you know, respected her and loved her, I think, for all of her life. It was fun to be able to write about a friendship between two women, because I don't think we tell enough stories like that.
For me, what was sad is that Clover really missed being on the river after she was done. And it was something that she thought about for the rest of her life. I mean, she went and did incredible botany afterwards in all sorts of wild places. She always wanted to get back to the river.
That's right. And yeah, she never came back, which is sort of heartbreaking. And I think a lot of people wonder about that, but I think it's also the case that at the time it wasn't easy. You know, like, you couldn't just, again, sign up for a commercial trip through the Grand Canyon. So she did come back to the region and hiked. She didn't do a river trip again, but she came back and spent time in the Grand Canyon on the rim and hiking around. She spent time with the Havasupai people who live in the canyon. But she never got a chance to do a river trip again.
But they wrote a book together that remained a classic.
They actually, it was just an article. They wrote an article together. There is one book about their journey down the river before mine, called The Wind, the Botany, and the Mexican Hat, which is a little book that's now out of print, I think. But what's interesting is the stories that have been told, the articles that have been written about them, often were not exactly what Alzada Clover would have liked. I found some letters where she complained about articles she read even decades later, saying, you know, this isn't how I want this story to be told. She wanted it to be focused on the science.
And, right, always. And that seemed to be both of their complaint, is that nobody would sort of look at the science they were doing. They were just looking at the fact that they were women.
Yeah. And that stayed for decades. I think really for the rest of Alzada Clover's life, that was a frustration for her. She never felt that the trip was recognized as being a serious scientific work, even by her own colleagues at the University of Michigan. So I hope that's something. But, you know, when you talk to botanists in this region, when I talk to Grand Canyon botanists, they know who these two women are. Huh. They use the papers they wrote. They wrote a couple of scientific papers about their discoveries, and those papers are absolutely classics up to today. And any botanist in this region knows who these women are and knows those papers, because they're still using it today.
Now, Jotter did get back to the river.
She did. She was invited back in the 1990s by the U.S. Geological Survey, which was putting together a trip designed to try to understand how the river has changed since Glen Canyon Dam was built, which went up in the 1960s. And one of the things they did was they brought back people that they called the old timers, and they were people who had run the river before the dam went into place. And one of those was Lois Jotter. She was, I think, 83 years old when she ran the river a second time. And it was fascinating to read her observations of how much had changed. Really, she said everything had changed, except for kind of the essential beauty of the place. Almost everything else had changed in those intervening, half a century.
Now, she became a champion of women in science.
She was. I think both of them were, in their own ways. They were both teachers and professors, and they both cared deeply about people getting an education in the environment and ecosystems, and you know, particularly supporting women to follow in their footsteps.
What I was amazed about is how enthusiastic they were about going down the rapids. There's some descriptions of Clover's first experiences of big water that seriously sound like Kate Hepburn in African Queen, where she finds it absolutely exhilarating. And then knowing what I now know about Clover, it perfectly fits with the fact that she would do that.
Right. Yeah, they both had, I think, a little bit of a daredevil streak.
Yeah.
More than Jotter, but they both really loved the rapids. They really connected with the river and the place. I mean, it's an extraordinary experience even today to run the Grand Canyon. And I think you do come out of that experience with a deep love and a deep connection to the place. And I saw that in both of these women.
We only have a few minutes left, but I want to mention Boy, did they hate grape nuts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, gosh, some of the food that they ate on this trip was not very appetizing. And at one point, they have clumps of moldy grape nuts that they're breaking apart with a rock because that's all they have to eat. And unsurprisingly, Lois Trotter never ate grape nuts again.
Well, and one of the most interesting people in the book, other than the people who went on the expedition, was Buzz Holmstrom. Who had to do a 180.
Yeah, he was a wonderful character to write about. He kind of starts the book as the villain, right? He kind of hangs over the start of their trip as this very famous river runner who said very publicly that women didn't belong in the Grand Canyon. And that would come back to bite him later when he had a chance to meet these two women. And it's a wonderful kind of redemptive arc to his story. He was one of my favorite characters to write about, just because seeing how Clover and Jotter changed his mind about women in the Grand Canyon was really wonderful to see.
It was incredible. His after the expeditions, correspondence with them was just amazing. It's like he developed a huge crush on them.
Yes. Yeah, he became very fond of both these women, and they of him, you know, and they exchanged letters for many years after this trip, and it was a nice moment and a surprising moment. I think if I had been writing this as fiction, I would have never told that story that way. But sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction.
Now, are they memorialized in plant names?
Clover is. Clover has a cactus that's been named after her.
Very appropriate.
And they did describe four species of cactus in the Grand Canyon region that that hadn't been described before for botany. None of those are named after them, but you know, you can see their names if you look up the formal Latin name. It says Clover and Jotter right after it as the discoverers of those species.
What are you going to work on next?
I don't know yet. But I really felt very satisfied doing this.
This is a perfect book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
It's a great story. I mean, it's got a beginning, a middle, an end, and then a great after story in the denouement. My guest tonight has been writer Melissa L. Svigny, science journalist at KNAU, Arizona Public Radio, and we've been talking about her latest book. It's just a great read. Brave the Wild River, the untold story of two women who mapped the botany of Grand Canyon. Melissa, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.